Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news. Welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John. This week, we'll be dedicating our episode to Scratch, a FinTech focused exclusively on loan servicing. As usual, with me is Steve.
Hey, everyone.
And our guest is Jeanette Quick, Deputy General Counsel and Head of Compliance at Scratch. Hello, Jeanette.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. So just to get us started, what does Scratch do exactly?
So we are a loan servicer, and we are in the private student loan market and personal loans. Some people don't know what servicing is. So servicing is basically everything that happens after a lender originates a loan and before it is either charged off or paid off in full. So anything that you would typically think of that a borrower has in the relationship between a lender, so sending your payments to pay off your loan, receiving statements, customer service, all of those activities are servicing, as well as delinquency management, early intervention for delinquencies, and helping borrowers when they're experiencing financial hardship and providing accommodations such as forbearance and deferment.
Oh, so you guys don't actually make the loans, but you kind of jump in and take care of all the processing and everything that happens after the loan is made?
That's right. So as soon as the lender makes the loan, they usually have a pre-existing relationship with the servicer. So it could be the next day, it could be immediately, it could be sometimes weeks or months later. But the originator would basically transfer the files over to the servicer, and that's us. Sometimes lenders have servicers in-house, so they would just service their own loans. But most of the time, there's a third-party servicer.
What is the process to actually become a servicer for a loan? Is it sort of a bidding process? How does that work?
There are a certain number of servicers out there in the world. There really aren't that many of them, and they tend to be categorized by asset class. So there's only a certain number of mortgage servicers, a certain number of student loan servicers, personal loan servicers. So people in the industry tend to know, you know, which servicers are out there and have been around for a while. There hasn't been a lot of development in the servicing world. Mm-hmm. A lot of the ones that have been around for a long time, and they tend to be specialized.
So would you guys, could you guys be sued for some of the, is it a big legal risk for you guys, for any loan servicer that's out there?
Yeah, so there are a number of state and federal regulations that we have to comply with, especially in the mortgage space. There were a number of regulations that were implemented after the crisis, and they require things of servicers like having a single point of contact that borrowers can talk to, having a certain set of disclosures, ensuring that people's foreclosures are handled accurately and that all the correct paperwork is there for borrowers. We saw it like during the crisis that was...
There's one or two little problems during the crisis,
right.
Right.
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of things there. But yeah, so we have to comply with a number of state laws. Also in student loan servicing, there are 5 states now that have student loan servicing laws, and those require things as varied as exactly what you can show to a borrower on your website, your display of what kinds of repayment options they have, what kinds of options you give them when they're experiencing hardship. Mm-hmm. In the federal student loan space, it's super regulated. There are something like 35 different types of repayment plans. So all of your representatives need to be able to walk through those types of repayment plans, understand the differences, understand who's eligible for what type of plan, make sure that they know how to recertify every year if you're talking about like income-based repayment or some of those other types of plans. So there's a lot to keep track of as a servicer. This is just kind of scratching the surface because there's also, you know, you're reporting to credit bureaus, so you need to follow the Fair Credit Reporting Act. If the loans are going delinquent, then you're also acting as a debt collector. So then you have to follow the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act.
And just to be clear, you guys started after the financial crisis, right?
Yes, we did.
Okay, just want to make sure. This is not their fault.
We did. And we actually take the enforcement actions that came out of that kind of as lessons learned, you know, kind of as a blueprint of things not to do. Like that is those have been very informative to us, informing how we go about compliance and legal regulation.
So does your company get classified as a reg tech company as well, or?
So that isn't typically how we have been classified, but I think we could be, partly because we have tried to figure out how we can implement certain compliance checks into the process from the beginning, mm-hmm. so that there are, in the case of student loans, when we're talking about the different state laws, so California, Illinois, Washington, Connecticut, and DC are the states that have student loan laws. So we have basically looked at those laws, figured out what's in common, what's different between them, and baked them into our product from the very beginning so that there's limited customer service subjectivity to it.
Yeah, yeah. It's always the execution that seems to be trouble, that gets the banks in trouble. Mm-hmm. I think it was Wells Fargo that got in trouble for that as well. Oh, I'm sure a lot of the large banks and collection companies have had that.
It seems like a fairly common thing. Great. So what would you say are the advantages that Scratch offers over the incumbents in the loan servicing space?
So a lot of the incumbents are dealing with technology that is decades old. They were created over the last 20, 30, 40 years.
It's all mainframe computers, I'm assuming.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So they have old technology. They also continue to do a lot of things manually. Mm-hmm. So for example, it may be that you have to call the servicer to change your due date or to change your payment amount or the cadence of your payment if you want to make payments more than once a month. That's all manual sometimes. Or it might also be manual if you want to call in for accommodations. There's not really like a process where you can call to get a deferment or you can go online to get a deferment. So there's a lot of manual overhead with existing servicers.
We've seen this in other fintechs where they're not able to take advantage of all the new machine learning or because just getting all the data from, they might have a payment system that's 40 years old, another processing foreclosure system that's 30 years old, and the customer service system is 20 years old, and none of those speak the same language, so that a new player has this all planned out and designed to work together from the beginning, and hopefully you'll get so big that you have that problem someday.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So can I choose my loan servicer as if I... Back when I was still paying my monthly
deposit.
No, you can't.
You can't.
No. You cannot. Okay. No. So your model is exclusively B2B.
Yes. So our clients are our lenders or originators. But since we are borrower facing, it is very important to us to have a strong borrower relationship. It's important to us to continue to have our brand in the platform so borrowers know that they're dealing with us. And because it is B2B, that is actually a reason I think there hasn't been a lot of competition in the space and there hasn't been a lot of improvement. Partly because some servicers don't necessarily put their brand out front. So the originator or the lender takes the hit if there is any bad servicing going on because most borrowers will associate the loan with the lender and they don't associate it with this other party. Second, because the brand isn't out there, there isn't reason to compete because you're kind of, you know, able to shield yourself from the...
You're just kind of a nameless...
Right.
And you're kind of locked into this contract, right? Because you're the one handling everything. There's no need for you to be best of breed if you don't have competition to take away a contract. There's a high barrier to entry, right?
Right. It also seems like... is there a lot of movement? Like, is there a lot of... selling and trading of debt as well to different servicers? Does that happen? Because I feel like I've made payments to more than one servicer back when I was paying my student loan debt. It was sort of a bunch of names. I just paid the amount, but it felt like it was changing every 2 years or so.
Yeah, so there is a lot of servicing transfers, especially in federal student loans. The Department of Education has certain set contracts. The contracts typically last for 5 years, but it's based on certain performance metrics. So if there are certain characteristics with the loan portfolios, it's common for the Department of Ed to transfer those loans to different servicers. It also happens a lot in mortgages. It happens a lot in lots of different contexts. So that is something, and that's something that has been a hiccup for a lot of companies and for borrowers in the past, that when something is transferred, it can be confusing to the borrower. There can be situations where there are lost payments or there are documentation things that go missing, right? So people no longer have access to their promissory note or payments have gone missing. My own student loans got transferred many times and payments went missing. And it took like 6 months to sort that out.
Right, right. Just one loan can have several different loan servicers over its lifetime.
Right. And a couple other things that I wanted to mention about the ways our technology is better. So also just the front end interface is a lot more intuitive than what's out there today. So I know, for example, my mortgage servicer right now, like it's pretty bare bones. The platform, you know, it kind of just has my information. It does have my promissory note, but it just has a basically make your payment and that's all you can do. So our platform, it looks a lot more like what you would expect from a modern app or tech company, which is that it has the ability to chat at any time. It has the ability to kind of click on different buttons and see information about your loan, to click on Help Center articles. Eventually, we'd like to roll out bots that kind of tell you more information, things like that. So it's meant to be more intuitive. We do user testing to make sure that's what's going on.
The option. You can skip a payment after a certain number of period of time, and some kind of more up-to-date options that maybe other systems don't support, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And we're also looking to figure out how to use data in a more interesting way to both see what works for people, but also to intervene early on delinquency. So an example there is if someone has given us access to their bank account information through a third-party interface, then we have information about what that person's normal income and expense flow looks like. So, you know, if someone gets a payment every 2 weeks from what looks like an employer and suddenly they stop receiving that payment, then we can surmise that they have lost their job. And we can better intervene early to ask them if something's going on, if they have lost their job, if they're going to need some kind of accommodation, if they need to pause their payments, things like that.
Sure. Preventative medicine is the best, yeah.
That's pretty cool. So can you do that even before they inform you that they might have lost their job? So you can actually just contact them, you know, prior to the loan amount being due?
That's right. So we can't do that today, but that is something that we are planning to get to.
It's on the roadmap.
It's on the roadmap.
Yeah. I've seen you've been Facebook posting tiers about money. Yeah. Is something going on? What's happening here?
Right,
exactly. Yeah, so we would be able to use data in that way to be able to reach out to them before they reach out to us.
And have answers.
And have answers, have options ready for them, and kind of be able to educate them on what they can do to help themselves and to kind of feel like they have a partner in the loan process.
So is there a lot of competition in this? You mentioned that the founders were noticing that no one was addressing this issue, but now have other people jumped in? Is this a hot space in fintech?
It is not a hot space.
Well, good for you. I'm glad you have it too. What is it? Deep blue ocean strategy.
You know, because I think there are a lot of institutional barriers in the space, right?
Just
because
all those legal regulatory liabilities you can get into, yeah?
Exactly. So there are a lot of legal and regulatory barriers, state and federal.
Lots of opportunities to get sued, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are also barriers in the way the industry is structured because there isn't borrower choice. And so you basically... You can't be a service that a borrower hears about and is like,
just because they love you, right? Doesn't mean really you get more business out of that, right?
Exactly, right. They can't just sign up for us. So even having a good borrower brand, there's kind of like a chicken or the egg problem there where, you know, you kind of have to have a tipping point where enough borrowers have to ask their lender for the servicer to be partnered with the lender, which seems like a very big tipping point, right? So then you need to have lender buy-in or originator buy-in. And I think many of the originators we have liked us and have said that we have superior products to other servicers that they've seen. But there is some kind of, you know, institutional memory. There's people that have had relationships with existing servicers for a long time. It also costs a lot to change from your old servicer to your new servicer. I mean, we mitigate those costs where we can, but it is just an operational thing that originators would need to take into account is that you are moving to a brand new system. So sometimes even if you're on a system that isn't the best one, the fact that you've been on it for a long time is something that keeps you there.
Stasis, basically.
Yeah.
So it sounds like Scratch focuses mainly on student lending and mortgages?
So right now we focus on student loans and personal loans. We are focused on getting into mortgage servicing in the next year or so.
I saw that NMLS number on your website there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so mortgages are a much more complex area than student loans and personal loans. So we were planning to get into that. It is a huge part of the consumer finance market, but we have a lot of planning before we get there.
Dumb question. Is the mortgage lending market bigger than the student lending market? Is that high greater? I assume it is.
It is. The mortgage lending market is about $9 trillion, and the student loan market is about $1.5
trillion. Oh, wow. So it's significantly bigger. Yeah.
But student lending is catching up.
It is catching up.
It's catching up to those houses, yeah.
I think the Times had an article this past week about sort of the ballooning student loan debt in the U.S. and how a lot of that is sort of underreported, and the default rates are actually much higher than we think. So I think if you can sort of trace that line, I think from the mid-90s or so to 2018 now, and it's pretty fascinating upward, like hockey stick line.
Yeah.
To see that go up.
Yeah, I remember a magazine cover from 2 years ago saying going to college was the worst mistake I ever made.
Yeah.
About the student lending crisis, I guess it is. And the change, I guess, 15 years ago, where you can't get rid of your student loans in bankruptcy anymore.
They're with you forever, yeah.
So it's very rare exceptions where the judge will allow a student loan to get wiped out in bankruptcy.
That's some good lobbying there by the
student loan industry. Right. So that takes away the incentive for people to make good loans. Because they know that no matter what,
the government will.
They're going to keep. Going to keep collecting from you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a great segue to my next question, which is: you came from the OCC, right? You used to work at the OCC in DC.
Oh, good memory, Steve.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you. And I know that they recently published some guidelines around creating a regulatory sandbox for fintechs. What do you see the regulatory sort of system be in light of all these new fintech stuff coming out of the whole country?
Is that good news for Scratch, in other words, I guess?
Yeah, so I'll take that in two parts. So I think the OCC's action, it has the same problems and challenges, I think, that the proposal they put out last year does, which is that a number of fintechs may still think that it doesn't go as far as they need it to in terms of preempting state laws. So they would still need to deal with a number of state consumer protection and other financial laws. And the consumer advocates and state regulators will, you know, still be upset that it...
Protect consumers enough?
The consumer advocates and the state regulators will likely sue again about the OCC exceeding its authority and not being able to preempt state laws.
So as a fintech, if you get sort of a free pass to circumvent any federal law, you can still be held you can still break state laws and get in trouble for that. My impression was...
Are you saying that OCC is preempting the states from doing that?
Yes, yeah, so an OCC charter would typically preempt state laws.
Oh, okay. So then the states don't like being preempted. Yes. They still want the right to have their own banking rules, and that's why they're suing the OCC.
Interesting.
Yeah, so when the OCC came out with its previous proposal, the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, the CSBS, sued about that proposal, and I believe that case was basically dismissed because the judge said that the issue wasn't ripe yet. So I think that this latest iteration... the OCC is kind of really pushing for a company to apply for this type of charter. I believe it would lead to the CSBS suing again, and hopefully then it would be a ripe issue and it would actually be more of a substantive legal judgment on whether it is permissible or not.
Which would make it a much clearer regulatory landscape for fintechs and wanting to try something out. Getting this exception, getting OCC stamp of approval, and not having to go through multiple states and other regulatory bodies, presumably. So we're on the OCC side in this argument, aren't we?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think there is something to be said for the state protections that are in place. I understand why consumer advocates and CSBS would be, upset about that. There had been criticism of the OCC in the past during and before the financial crisis for not doing enough to protect consumers. And so to the extent that there is state law that is more beneficial to consumers, that maybe the OCC shouldn't be doing this. I don't necessarily know that I believe that it exceeds the OCC's authority to do this. I think it may be in line with their authority, but I think this is something that is kind of a confusing part of the statutory framework there. And it will be interesting to hear how a judge comes out on that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's actually, that does remind me actually of something I read about the financial crisis saying that the states were preempted from regulating mortgage loans. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the many causes of the financial crisis is had they been able to rein in that out of control lending, that would have offset or decreased some of the damage that was done. So yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, and I think it remains to be seen whether any fintech will step forward to be this first guinea pig to apply for the fintech charter and be maybe somewhat the sacrificial lamb that will be the case that's litigated about. So I think, in the past, that was why nobody stepped forward last go around. It'll be interesting to see whether anyone steps forward this time to be that sacrificial lamb.
Yeah, from the news reports that I saw a few weeks after the ruling came out, it seems like they hadn't received a single application in the first like 6 or 7 weeks after the thing being opened. So everyone's a bit reticent to jump all in.
Well, yeah, that makes a lot more sense. Great to get some background on that. So is the environment pretty, it seems pretty free-flowing. The money's really out there for good fintech ideas. Is that the case with you guys, or are you a special case?
I think it is out there for fintech. It seems like every day we're hearing about new companies being funded and variations on similar themes, often in the lending space. I think that we are getting interest in funding because servicing is a space that hasn't really been disrupted. It hasn't had a lot of innovation in the past, and a lot of lenders or originators that are in the space know that there is need for something else. So when people talk to people that we work with and hear that we have a good product, it's something that kind of sells itself.
So you're doing the student and personal lending now. I'm sure you need the funding for the mortgage side of the world. That's a whole other, a much larger world in terms of all the rules you have to comply with. Why expand to the mortgage market so soon? And have you expanded as much as you can already in student lending? Or
it's a good question. I think because the mortgage market is such a huge part of the servicing market, it's 9 of 13 trillion. So that is a place where a lot of originators are looking for a better solution. So we constantly get pinged by mortgage originators that are asking for more information about servicing. So there's kind of the business need for it there. I think we are certainly expanding on the student loan and personal loan space. There's always room to grow there. And we are, continuing to do things like develop our data analysis and delinquency management and things like that. And that would go for across asset classes. So I think these things are kind of happening in parallel. So we're continuing to expand on the non-mortgage space, and at the same time we'll be expanding into mortgages. And before we get there, we'll need to hire a team of mortgage experts. We'll be, need to hire a lot more engineers and everything like that.
And maybe product managers, Steve. Maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're looking for something.
Perhaps. We'll see. We'll take this offline.
So you mentioned a lot of the automation and chatbots that you guys are using. Is a lot of the team building that kind of technology to make a smarter servicing company? In other words, are you using machine learning and trying to develop that chatbot on your own, or are you partnering with other technology providers?
So we're not partnering with technology providers at this time. We are building everything in-house.
From scratch.
From scratch. We're going to say that multiple times, yeah.
So we're building everything from scratch, and we currently are using the chat function. It is not a bot at this time, but we will be using AI, machine learning, to inform that process on how do we make that more automated and something that can be less overhead, kind of less manual, less like a person needing to do certain things that are simple.
And it sounds like smarter for the borrower as well, right?
Right, exactly. We found that actually chat is our most popular form of communication because most people, they want to be able to just chat while they're doing something else. Basically, I find that in my own customer service activities is I'd rather chat also. I don't want to get on the phone. I don't want to email back and forth. I would rather just deal with it right away. And so that has been something that's very instructive is just making a change as simple as that actually takes away a lot of friction, where you can figure out that if someone is having trouble making a payment or if they just can't log in or something like that and they can be able to chat with you, you can solve that in just a few minutes and it doesn't need to be a prolonged back and forth and phone call.
Or pressing five different numbers to get to the right thing.
Phone tree. Yeah,
go straight through in a chat bot and get through. We talked about this a few episodes back where there's a company in Spain that does a choose your own adventure kind of chat bot instead of like a full AI technology kind of thing. So we'll send you the link in case you want to talk to them.
Awesome.
But that's something, sometimes a simpler solution, but whatever works best for the customer, I guess.
So you're sort of in the private student loan space. Have you entered or have you tried to enter the federal student loan segment?
So we have bid on the federal student aid office's Next Gen proposal, which is their proposal to revamp the federal student loan market. As of just today, they announced that they are rescinding a couple key parts of that. So there are a number of barriers to getting into that market. As I mentioned before, there are just a few federal student loan servicers in that market. There are nine or so, but there are actually really only three that have something like 85-90% of the portfolio of the 90% of the $1.5 trillion. So there is very little competition in the federal student loan market, and these contracts tend to be somewhat set in stone. The Federal Student Aid Office renews them every 5 years, and basically if you're in, you're in, and you don't have a chance to go in for another 5-6 years, and it has been the same players for many years.
And I assume that if you're out, it's kind of a hurdle to actually get in, so it's kind of a barrier of entry.
That's right. There have been, in the last couple years, a number of state laws that have been passed in a bunch of states, and those state laws have also been a new barrier to entry. I think, from Scratch's viewpoint, we are supportive of many of the state laws in that they are, creating borrower protections and ensuring that there are full disclosures in both federal and private student loans. So we have been supportive of those laws, but would like to mention that, they can be a bit confusing or conflicting to comply with at times, and we would advocate for a uniform standard across states.
I always look for uniform standards across states, actually, too.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Jeanette. And now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the story behind it. Well, my final bite is 11.2%. Can you guess what that is, Steve?
It's a pretty low number, but I have no idea.
All right. Well, that is, it's an unfortunate number, actually. It's the amount of student debt that was 90 plus days delinquent as of Q3 2017. I never would have guessed that number would be that high.
That seems pretty high, yeah, insane.
I mean, it does really make it sound like when people say a student loan crisis, that it really is a crisis.
I wonder, during the height of the recession, what percentage of mortgages were in default? Or
student loans?
No.
In comparison.
Right.
And I think that the article that Steve mentioned earlier also talks about how the student loan debt actually may be as high as, what was it, 20%?
20%.
20% delinquent when you take into account deferments and people that are in school, things like that. Yeah. And my number is $13 trillion, which is the amount of household debt that Americans have as of, I think, a quarter ago. So it has probably increased since then. And basically every quarter, the all-time high is reached again. So it's still in a period where debt is increasing, and that is a very alarming number.
So it's setting a record, in other words.
Exactly.
A record high.
Wow. Yeah, a record. Let's hear it. So this is just personal loans, non-real estate loans?
This includes real estate loans.
Mortgages, credit cards, personal loans, student loans, all of that, yeah.
Okay. So consumer, personal side.
Consumer loans, yeah. I think the breakdown is roughly $9 trillion mortgage, $1.5 trillion student, $1 trillion credit cards, $1 trillion auto loans, and then the rest is miscellaneous.
$1 trillion auto loans? That seems so high. Who buys a car for $1 million?
Well, there's more than 1,000 loans, so yes.
That is a bit weird, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for joining us for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. And thanks to our special guest, Jeanette Quick from
JQ,
yes, as she prefers to be called, of Scratch.fi, who is the Deputy General Counsel and Head of Compliance. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest episodes. Please feel free to email us with any questions or comments at info@fintechnewscast.com. And thanks for listening.
Bye for now.
Bye, thank you.